Hello, and I guess good afternoon. My name is Roger Lang, and I'm a patent attorney. I actually work up in Minnesota, but I'm actually from the Atlanta area. I went to Georgia Tech, go Jackets. They had a good night last night, and I was asked to talk about Alice. But before we get started on that and the idea of what is and is not patentable subject matter, I guess I have to give the usual disclaimers. I am not your lawyer. Nothing I say in this room is considered to be legal advice. You should not act or refrain from acting based on anything I say. The only legal advice I ever give people for free is to hire a lawyer. And usually that lawyer is not me, unless it's related to patents. You get a lot of family who wants, you know, to help you with something. I don't do that. So the idea with Alice, how many of you have actually heard of Alice? How many of you are lawyers? Patent lawyers. All right. Some of you know, I mean, obviously the patent system is something that's founded under federal law, and in terms of what is considered patentable subject matter, the law states, whoever invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof, may obtain a patent, therefore, subject to the conditions and requirements of this title. That is 35 U.S.C. 101. Sounds, I guess, relatively simple, but it's not. There are a lot of exceptions to what is and is not patentable. Alice deals with what they refer to as judicial exceptions. The courts have basically said there are some things that we're just not going to allow a patent on. Laws of nature are one example. You can't patent gravity because you discovered it. Now, if you can think of something useful and concrete that uses gravity, more power to you. You can might be able to patent that. But what happened is, depending upon who you talk to, again, different commentators have different opinions, and I don't mean to express one way or the other which one is right or wrong. Some people viewed Alice as an attack against the troll problem, if you want to even call that a problem. Some people have viewed Alice as the Supreme Court just doesn't like patents. I don't know. They have taken up a lot of the Supreme Court has taken up a unusually large number of patent cases lately. I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, but they've taken up a lot of cases. For some reason, they have a fondness of patent law, and they want to interject on it. That is their prerogative. The Alice was generally thought by some of the Supreme Court members. There was a posting once where someone was speaking with one of the justices, and they thought Alice would actually be a minor case, not that big a deal. It turned out to be a huge deal. Since Alice, a lot of cases that were normally getting through the patent office and patents were being issued, they just haven't. Things that are generally thought of as software-type patents. It has stretched into some other areas. It's beyond the scope of today. But since Alice, I have some statistics here. Let's see. In federal court cases involving, you know, this idea of 101 patentable subject matter, about 74% of the stuff gone up has been found invalid under using 101 basis as something that's not patentable subject matter. And that's pretty substantial because, I mean, before it got to court, it probably got through the patent office. Now, some of this stuff was on appeal from the patent office. So that's kind of, it's a lot. I have some other statistics. No one cares about those. Now, some courts tend to be a little bit different. I mean, you have some breakdowns. Like, for example, cases where things have found to be valid under 101. If you're in the Middle District of North Carolina, the Eastern District of Michigan, Western District of Wisconsin, Southern District of Texas, and the District of Massachusetts, they have yet to find a case invalid. That said, there's only been one case in each of those districts. So I don't know if that means a whole lot or not. Now, the Eastern District of Texas, that is another place that is relatively, people like that in the patent world. The Eastern District of Texas is, some people call it the rocket docket. A lot of people like to sue there. Let's see. In that particular district, 5 were found invalid and 11 were found valid. So maybe that's another place that if you're gonna, might want to sue somebody there if you're the patent holder, if you're the defendant, maybe it's not as good a place to sue. All right. Now, certain technology centers or examining groups within the patent office have found to be a little more, you see a lot more rejections in those areas. Some of the ones like 3600 and 3700, I don't know exactly what each of those groups does, but in those particular groups, you tend to find more Alice-type rejections. And we just call them Alice rejections. When they first came out, I think a lot of people, the patent office didn't know how to reject under Alice, and people weren't 100% sure how to respond to a rejection under Alice. You get a one paragraph boilerplate language saying, this is an abstract idea, it's not patentable, it's rejected. And that was a common one. I had cases that were allowed, and then the patent office came back after Alice and said, no, these are not allowable, and issued a 101 rejection. And basically, the rejection would say, you know, using the boilerplate language, that this is just using computers to do things that were already known in the art. Well, my counter argument is pretty obvious in that one. If it was stuff that's known in the art, why did you allow the thing in the first place before Alice? So it can't be well known and then also just routine. That doesn't make sense. That would get you so far, because I think the patent office at the time was just trying to buy some time to figure out what to do, waiting on some cases to come down. Practitioners were in the same boat. I mean, we were trying to argue against a form paragraph. I mean, it's like arguing with yourself. As the practitioners were figuring out, you know, ways that were effective, courts were coming out with decisions. Some of that would help. The patent office actually has a lot of material on their website that they use for training examiners. They actually have worksheets that kind of detail some of the steps that the examiners would go through in trying to figure out, is something eligible or ineligible subject matter using the Alice guidelines. And, you know, those things are helpful. As a practitioner, we can look at those and maybe try to recreate the steps of the examiner and say, okay, here's why it's patentable, you know, before they get to the point where they say it's not patentable. When you have an examiner interview, you can use some of those worksheets. I know practitioners who will sort of fill out those worksheets themselves, send that to the examiner as talking points, and they find that to be helpful. Some people have done that. Let's see. I think that should be enough on the statistics. I don't think anybody wants to hear a bunch of that. The information I have, like I said, we have some of the cases we can talk about. Some of them that they've gone through. I'm not going to just run through a bunch of cases because we literally don't have enough time for that. There are some of them that were, and most of them, everything is found ineligible so far. There's some eligible, some not ineligible, or some eligible and some not ineligible, if that makes sense. A lot of this started off, have any of you heard of Bilski? Do you know what that means? Some people think that's what sort of started all this rolling. In Bilski, the idea there was, it was a hedging, basically a patent on trying to hedge risk. And the court said, no, you can't do that. A lot of people, you know, there were a lot of amicus briefs for people saying, yes, this should be patentable, no, this shouldn't be patentable. The same with Alice. There were a lot of amicus briefs for people saying that no, software is not patentable. Some people saying yes, it is. It just depends on what you want to look at. And then, so Bilski sort of laid a little bit of groundwork, and some people, you know, it took a little while. Even after Bilski, it took a while. You know, some cases came down. People had to try to figure out, okay, where is the law heading in this? And hate to say it, but you had to wait for litigators to do something. And most people don't like when litigators do something because it usually costs a lot of money. But with Alice, there was like kind of a two-part test was set up. First, you got to figure out, is this an abstract idea? And then, well, if it's an abstract idea, then you got to figure out, well, is there something more to this that makes it, that would bring it back into the realm of patent-eligible subject matter? Because an abstract idea by itself is not patentable. Now, the question is, first of all, what is an abstract idea? Some people, they argue over just what that is. If it's something, you know, what we've seen with some of the practice, if you are dealing with money or just general data crunching, that's probably going to wind up in that abstract idea area. The question then, you know, then you have to go to that second step. Is this a little bit more? Is there something else to this that sort of brings it back into the realm of patent eligible subject matter? And again, that's one of those that right now we're still trying to figure out, what does it take to bring it back into the patent eligible subject matter? Some of the things that we have, what I can talk about a couple of cases, because some of them it's like, wow, really? There was one case in particular, I'm not going to like go into all the names and stuff like that, but there was one of them that had to deal with heads-up displays for jet airplanes, fighter airplanes. And basically the idea was, without getting into all the claim language, which the idea was that as the pilot, a lot of times the heads-up display is on like the front of the cockpit, so if they're not looking at the front of it, they don't see it. Well, the idea was that they figured out a way to put it on their visor so when they turn their head, it's always right in front of them. And there's a whole lot of problems with that because you have so many different reference planes. You know, the plane's going this way, the guy's looking this way, and the data is all staying in front of him, and it depends on where he's looking as to what data he gets. He could be going in one direction, look here, and get one set of data on his display, and as soon as he turns his head, it's just going to change because it depends on where he's looking. And the idea there is to figure that out, the mathematics and everything behind it is pretty complicated. And the claims that were involved in there, they were found invalid. They're like, well, you're just doing some math, basically. I mean, it was a little more complicated than that, but all right. So what if that's not enough? I mean, you figured out a problem that people have been working on for a long time, and they figured out a way to do it. Some people will say that it's because of the way the claims were written. Some people will say that's just an abstract idea. And again, it's, you know, I'm not trying to say that, yeah, it should have been patentable or it shouldn't have been patentable. It's just a question of really who's looking at it as to whether or not it meets the elements of the test. And you can get past that. Okay, first, is that an abstract idea just to say that adjusting data on a heads-up display, that's abstract? I don't know. Someone said it was. So then the second question that follows up is it more? So is there something else extra to that? Is there something else in this patent application and claims that will get you past the abstract idea that brings it back into the realm of patent eligible subject matter? You know, some people will say that if the claims were written differently, it would have been patentable and they would have been fine. Some people say if it was not, there's nothing that could have saved it. Again, it's all a question. I don't mean to be vague or anything, but typical lawyer answer, it depends. It really just depends. Some of the guidance that people are using now is they're looking for almost in like an analogy type form. They will look at certain cases that have come out and they will try to figure out, is what I'm doing similar to this case? If it is, how can I distinguish over this if this particular case was found to be ineligible subject matter? If it was found to be eligible subject matter, I'm doing what they're doing, so I'm fine, kind of thing. And that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's what people do with case law all the time. You try to figure out how you are similar to what's already been decided in your favor and play off of those points. Another case that there was one, it was, let's see, I got it in my notes here. And this one, one guy, I'll never forget this, he said that if ridiculousness was a grounds for rejection, the case would have died on that one. But that's actually not a basis for rejecting a patent application. Although the patent office can deny patents on things that would hold the patent office up to ridicule. there was an example of someone got a patent. When you sit on a swing and you pull the chain sideways, you'll swing sideways instead of back and forth. That it actually got allowed, and then it went through a re-exam, and the patent office canceled it. It's pretty hilarious. The guy that got it was a patent attorney, too. He got it. I think his kid was sitting on a swing or something. Pretty funny. Someone got a patent on exercising a cat with a laser pointer on the floor. So there's some weird things you can get a patent. Like, something like that, if it were to go back through the patent office, I'm pretty sure it would die under analysis, you know, rejection. I don't know how that's anything but that. But there was one case that had to do with dieting. Basically, you'd have menus of pictures on the menu board, and you could select stuff, and you could customize your diet. And they're like, well, no, that's just an abstract idea, right? Because it's just people plan their diet in their head all the time. If you want to write it down on paper, fine. If you want to use a menu and a list of computers or a list of menus to try to figure that out, okay, go ahead. But that wasn't enough. You couldn't just do that. So, you know, one of the things to look at is, you know, what is the... If you think you're in the realm of abstract ideas, you want to try to figure out what is some kind of structure to that that can help bring you, that can help pull you back. If your point of novelty is not in something that is considered abstract, probably won't have a whole lot of problems. I mean, you may run into them. It just depends on what you're doing. But sometimes the point of novelty is in that abstract idea. And I think you see a lot of that with the software, with like financial methods. That's usually where you see a lot of the Alice type stuff. If you have one of the things I've noticed and stuff that I've seen is if it's something that's happening on like a back-end server where you don't really see it, it just sort of happens in the ether and appears on your phone or your computer, a lot of times that can be a problem, because then it's hard to say, well, is that tied to some kind of concrete thing, some form of technological implementation, as opposed to just a generic server that's doing something? And that can be a problem. I mean, you have to try to figure out a way to distinguish that. The examples are some of the notes that I use when I'm working and try to think these things through are the... You know, just looking at these things from kind of a high level, if your point of novelty is in that realm of something that's abstract, like I say, that could lead you into problems. It could get you in trouble. There's other things you want to try to tease out of the invention to sort of bring it back into the technological realm. If your point of novelty lies in the technological nature of it, again, that's usually not, you don't run into the Alice problem as much. If you're sort of in the middle of the two, you're like, well, this part of my point of novelty is in this, and then in the abstract part, and then part of it's not, it's in the way that I implement it. That's where you can, again, have some of that gray area, and may take a lot of time and a lot of back and forth with the patent office and maybe even the courts to figure out whether or not what you're doing is patentable, or if that type of technology is patentable. So some of the things that I've seen different practitioners do as they're drafting in view of some of the cases that are out there now, trying to figure out whether or not they can, you know, is this worth even trying to get a patent? Because some people are looking at stuff now. The patent office, there are some of the other statistics that are out there. There's been a good drop-off in filings in certain technology areas. And again, that's some of these ones that we had mentioned earlier where they're having these just huge rejection rates. You are seeing some drop-offs in filings. So are people wondering, well, are people just not filing now because they're afraid that they're going to hit an Alice rejection and they're not going to get a patent anyway? Getting a patent is not cheap. I mean, having an application drafted is depending upon how complicated it is. I mean, you could be looking at anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000. That's just to get it filed. That's not even getting into the back and forth with the patent office. I mean, you can spend a lot of money right up front. And some people are wondering, is it worth even trying to spend the money when I know I'm going to run into this huge ALIS battle. And if you end up having to appeal, you know, from the patent office, you get, the examiner rejects it. Now you got to appeal to the PTAB. Right? That's going to cost you a lot of money as well. And then if you lose there, do you want to take it to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit? Because, I mean, now you could easily be into this thing by the time you're done, $50,000, $100,000. I mean, litigators are pretty expensive, especially really good ones. So in that sense, you know, you could be spending a lot of money to try to get your patent. So some people just aren't filing now. They're like, it's not worth it. Things that would in the past, we were pretty confident that we wouldn't get some type of a 101 or a Bilski rejection, as we used to call them. We were pretty sure we weren't going to get that kind of rejection. Fine, we could just go forward. Some of the stuff now, we just don't know. So one of the things I'm seeing people do as they start with their patent drafting is they're trying to figure out, again, it goes back to this idea of where is your point of novelty? What is it you're looking at? Is your point of novelty in this idea of the way that you're doing something that is abstract? Are you bringing together data? Are you doing something that was considered a mental process? Even before ALIS and Bilski, I mean, there was case law about the idea of mental processes or simply, you know, implementing different things on a computer. There's been case law about that for a while. So it's not, well, all of a sudden ALIS means that if you just do it on a computer, you can't get a patent on it. That's not the case. Now, it's been that way beforehand. All right, so you got that idea. If the point of novelty, again, if it resides in that abstract idea, then you need to be careful. That's something you need to really sit down with your client or with your clients about and try to figure out, where are we going with this? Is there something more that we can look into? Because you're going to want to try to build into your application the different parts that you're going to need in case the ALIS rejection comes up. You want to be able to really tie that into some kind of structure that you're doing to move forward in a technological way, as opposed to just having a computer that does some stuff for you. And again, a lot of it will depend on the different technologies that we've seen. User interfaces, things like graphical user interfaces, sometimes those have helped people. Because again, I'm causing the display to do something that it normally wouldn't do. Some people have found that to be successful. Some people have run into roadblocks with it. Sometimes it just depends on the examiner you get. I mean, as arbitrary as that is, if some examiners are a little more hostile than others. So you have to be careful in that area. And if you get a hostile examiner, you can't request another one. You get who you get. So in that sense, you know, you're just stuck. If your point of novelty is in the technological part of how you're implementing something, people have found that to be less troublesome in terms of, okay, I can, you know, point to some kind of structure. I'm telling you how I'm making computer better, how I'm making it run better, how I'm making it run faster, things of that nature. So in that sense, people can, when they get to that second part of the test, because they usually are going to hit the app, they're going to be found to be considered an abstract idea, and they're saying, okay, now here I'm specifically tying that into some type of a technological advance. I'm not just using a generic computer. I'm not just doing generic things. I've tied that to this piece of technology, and I've advanced that piece of technology a step. And that step is what gets me into the patentable realm, instead of I'm just using a computer to do something that computers didn't do before. It's a little bit more than that, it seems like. There's no way I can tell you whether or not something is or is not patentable. The only 100% way to know if your invention is patentable is to file an application and see what happens. But as you're drafting, some of the things that people are looking towards is, trying to figure out, based on the examples that we have from the courts, what are some things that are helping to move cases into that patentable realm. That's really where we're at now. We're still waiting on more cases to try to help us figure out where we need to go and, you know, what we need to make sure is in our application so that we have that material that, in case we run into an Alice type rejection, that we can, okay, point to the technological advance that's taking place. And that's really, I mean, in the short and sweet, that's kind of where the state of it is right now. Where are you making a technological advance with whatever it is you're trying to patent? If you can point to that, then you'll probably have a better chance of getting through the patent office than somebody who can't point to that. And I thought it would take a little bit longer than that to say that, but that's really where we're at. I mean, I'm not going to just keep saying it's all in the technological step. I mean, there's no reason to keep going with that. But without just hashing through a bunch of example cases, there's no way to figure out whether or not what you have is patentable or not patentable. Without going through the patenting process, there's no way to really... We can make some educated guesses. We can look at what you're doing. And again, I hate to beat the dead horse here, but it all goes back to, can I point to some kind of a technological step that is moving me forward? And if you can... What do you mean?
What is the technological step like? We're trying to get to that significantly more.
Well, that's the thing, is that nobody knows. It's the to figure out what is the significantly more to get you over that hump in the second part of the Alice test. You want to have as much there in terms of the structure of what you're doing that you can get away with. One of the things that you're seeing now, at least I'm seeing, I don't know if everybody's seeing it, but I am, when people are drafting their claims or making their amendments, instead of trying to get the absolute broadest coverage they possibly, trying to claim the internet or something like that, they're pointing to, okay, this is what we're doing. This is our implementation. These are the components that we're using. These are how they interact. And they're creating something a little bit better in that sense, in that they're more focusing their claims and their description and their specification on, okay, here's what we're doing, and we're not going to just describe it in these broad terms or these really basic, almost, I don't want to say generic terms, but just these overly broad concepts so that they can try to snag every possible infringer. I think some people, again, some clients are different. Some clients will still fight for that kind of thing. They very much want the broad patent, and they're willing to fight for it. And they got the money to fight for it, so they'll do it. Some clients are more interested in, all right, this is what we do. We really want to keep other people from doing what we're doing because we believe that what we're doing gives us a business advantage. In that sense, they're really just worried about stopping that, so they'll be very focused with their claims, and they generally don't have as many type Alice problems because they're not afraid to say, okay, here's what I'm doing, here's A, B, C, and the pieces, and they'll be fine. But again, that to just say what is the significantly more, it's kind of one of those the courts will tell, we'll know it when we see it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that helps me a whole lot. But there really isn't, it sort of breaks down to that. You know it when you see it. Or the examiners know it when they see it, or the court knows it when they see it. So. Yes, sir.
Let me ask them.
Oh, he's got the.
How expensive is it to defend your patent?
If you get sued for, let's say you have a patent on something and you want to then sue someone for patent infringement, that it all depends again on how far that goes, and how complicated the technology is and the different expert witnesses you're going to need. You could be anywhere in that for cheaply $1 million, really expensive $5 million. Even more. Apple and Samsung, from what I understand in that battle, each of them have probably spent somewhere between 20 and 40 million in the Apple sound. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not, where they're basically fighting over design patents, which they have one claim, and it's, you know, they've spent just small fortunes. But again, it depends on how far the litigation goes to get through trial and up to appeals, things like that. You could easily, something very simple could easily cost you anywhere between $1 million, $5 million. It is not cheap at all.
And can you recover your legal expenses?
I'll get back to you in just 1 second.
And if you win the case, can you recover as the legal fees?
There are provisions. There are some fee shifting provisions in the law. And again, I think a lot of that comes down to a case by case basis as well. If something is egregious, then there can be patent fees. If someone is overly litigious, whatever that means, there can be a fee shifting. Some people think that the fee shifting should take care of the so-called trolls, because they're out there just suing everybody hoping for a quick settlement. And I'm sorry if I offended anyone with the use of the word trolls, non-practicing entities. Some of that, there are some examples where they have had fee shifting. But most people don't, it doesn't get that far. Most patent cases don't go to a verdict. They end up settling. Someone will lose on summary judgment and then they'll appeal that. But you just don't get to jury verdicts that often. I mean, it happens. Obviously, it does happen. And even then, you may or may not get your attorney's fees. There's no automatically, if you win, you get your attorney's fees, or if you lose, you have to pay the other side. There's no automatic provisions that I'm aware of. I don't do that much. I don't do any litigation, so that's not an area I have a lot of experience in.
Thank you. To kind of follow up on what he was asking, considering the high cost, how is it that the trolls, for lack of a better word, have been able to get those initial cases through, or is the cost something that's increased recently because of the persistence?
You mean the cost of getting it through the patent office, or
right,
the cost
you were
of litigation?
Saying, well, either one, but you were saying how much it costs even to get through the office itself, but then even further through litigation. Yet, if you have these people who are persistently doing that over and over again, where was their money coming from?
A lot of the initial cases, from what I understand, is they just buy patents that have already issued, so they don't have to go through the cost of getting a patent. They will purchase one. From what I understand, it's cheaper to buy a patent sometimes than it is to get one. So they will buy them, and then they will go out and try to enforce them. And going to the enforcement part, a company usually will settle before they'll try to go to trial. They know that if we took this to trial, we would probably win. We could either get it invalidated or we could get a judgment of non-infringement. Either one of those would be fine for the company. But if the non-practicing entity is like, well, we'll settle with you for $100,000, it's hard for the legal department to go justify to their board, well, we can beat them, but it'll cost us, you know, between $1 million and $5 million. Or we can just pay them $100,000 and go on. So it's some people refer to it as legal extortion. I mean, it's, to be honest with you, some people look at it that way. And I'm sure they don't look at it that way, but they look at it as they're protecting their legal interest to the fullest extent of the law. And, okay, more power to them, but.
So what if software doesn't really fit within the patent or the copyright regime? I mean, this whole new thing with computational devices, does it make sense to try and find a new category of IP and go to Congress and say, we need this thing that's specifically for software, even if it's abstract, and we say, maybe it's easier to get, shorter, something like that. It seems like you're trying to shoehorn something that doesn't quite fit in copyright or patent. You're trying to shoehorn something into all the systems that don't quite work. Has there been work done to try and come up with something new for software?
There are people who have talked about that. Like source code, for example, is copyrightable. Mm-hmm. You can copyright source code. well, that's not going to get you very far in terms of trying to defend against, you know, someone who's using your software, because you'd have to see their source code, and just going through discovery, things like that. Is copyright's not the most difficult thing to get around. But some people have thought that all of this could be taken care of with a couple of strokes of the pen from Congress. It, again, depends on which commentator you talk to, that they have said the Congress could modify 101 to specifically include software, or to specifically include certain things, because Congress will specifically exclude things. If I'm not mistaken, the American Invents Act, that actually had provisions that basically said any kind of tax strategy is prior art. They're not going to let you patent away to pay less taxes and keep other people from paying, you know, less taxes when they're legally allowed to do so. So some people think that Congress could easily fix this if they wanted to, if it even needs fixing. Again, it depends on which side of the fence you're on. A lot of the open source people, they love this kind of thing because they can do a lot. A lot of the, as weird as it sounds, even some of your big software players like your Googles and your Microsofts and stuff like that, they are filing amicus briefs in different areas. To some extent, you know, they are siding with some people saying that some stuff is not patentable. And I think in other areas they might be looking to say that something is patentable. You know, they... Again, it depends on who you look for. Certain companies, some people believe that a lot of the big giants now, they've used the patent system to make a lot of money, and they're trying to close the door behind them or lift the ladder up or whatever. And so they don't want stuff to be soft, to be patentable. Some people are like, well, sure they do, because they still make their money in software, so they need to be able to protect themselves. Some people think that if they don't patent things and stuff is not patentable in the software realm, then they're free to do pretty much whatever they want to, and they don't have to worry about spending a bunch of money on lawyers to defend themselves when they get sued. So, like I said, some people believe it could be fixed really simple. Like you said, quit trying to shoehorn software. I'm sure the founding fathers had no, they did not envision there would be a software thing that they would ever have to worry about. You know, the printing press was a marvel, and just leave it at that. So in that sense, you know, some people were saying, well, it doesn't fit. Now, there are some people that will argue that, well, this does, the current law does cover a process. Well, it doesn't say that it can't be a computer process. So what's the difference? So, I mean, that's sort of where you're at. But I think, you know, Congress could step in and do something if they wanted to. And then some people will tell you that Congress shouldn't do anything, because every time they do something, they make it worse. I mean, again, it just, where you fall in that particular spectrum as to what can and can't be done. What you got?
Hey, I have a comment and a question. Just to follow up on your point, when you were asking about a different class of subject matter, some of my clients have elected, because their process, their software is capable of cloud computing, you know, they'll sell the service to a client or to one of their clients to use it. They just keep it all a trade secret now. They're kind of thinking, okay, in view of Alice and this questionable climate right now, let's just keep it all secret. Right, and so in certain situations, I guess, you know, an investor going after the company would want to see patents, would want to see copyrights, but if the company itself is pretty self-sufficient, they may elect to just keep it a trade secret and protect their rights that way. You know, so until we get some more guidance.
And I have some clients as well who are there, they just look at it, they'll come back to it, and they're like, yeah, we're not going to actually release software that someone could, you know, break down. They could try to reverse it. We keep the software in-house. They send us some data or something like that, and we'll do the work. So, yeah, they'll just say, yeah, we'll just not tell anybody. Yeah. We have some pretty good confidentiality agreements with our employees. We pay them well so that they won't run off and try to steal the have a misappropriation of trade secrets or anything like that. So that is one realm. But, again, with something that you put out there into the system, you know, when Microsoft sells you Word, yeah, there's 15, 20 something pages of shrink wrap license that you click through. that says you won't reverse engineer it, but you could if you wanted to. You could go back and try to back out the source code essentially for a word. I mean, good luck to you if you can, but you can do that. So it's harder to try to keep that as trade secret, but like what he's saying, if you're selling a service and you want to keep all that in-house and as a trade secret, sure, why not?
And my question that I have for you now is, I practice in the field of biotechnology and medical diagnostics, and Alice is hitting me hard now from the medical diagnostic point of view, because they're basically saying to take a blood sample and to measure a cancer tumor marker and then determining if the person has cancer, that's just a mental process.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing Alice rejections based on just that sort of mental process. And I've had certain clients try, or other attorneys try, to dismiss it and say, oh, well, we're just gonna incorporate something like machine learning or a computer technology step. And I'm kind of wondering, as a software guy, do you think that's not gonna be too effective? Because you're still, even though you're having, you know, machine learning or some sort of computer application to it, it's still technically a mental process. And I know you can't comment too much, but even if you know of some cases that you referred to that may deal with this sort of issue, can you elaborate a bit?
I don't have any cases right off the top of my head that I can think of, but you're seeing that. I mean, I do work in some of the, my background's actually mechanical engineering, and I do work in medical devices as well. So something like a shoulder replacement, that's easy, right? I'm sitting there, I know that's not abstract. I can touch it and feel it and fondle it, and it's fine. But when you get into some of the stuff like you were talking with MRI machines, some of that gets a little tricky because, yeah, there's a giant machine there that costs hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, but a lot of what's going on in there is in the software realm. It's happening, you know, with the computers. So we're seeing that as well, even in, like you said, even in the diagnostic, but in the, you know, imaging and things like that. So again, it all just goes back to, who knows? I mean, what is it you can do to take you that extra step, to bring you into that technological realm? Because some people will argue that I can't mentally take an MRI. I gotta have a machine to do it. Without literally cutting you open and looking inside of you, I have no idea what's going on inside of you. Mm-hmm. So some people, well, how can that be abstract? Because it's not something I can do mentally. So there has to be this technological component to it. Some people were like, well, that may be the case, but you're just collecting some magnetic waves or something like that. And it's like, well, that's just abstract. Okay. I mean, there was even getting to some of the abstractness, and this is a little sort of software related, but there was a case where, like, when you're dealing with software, a lot of times people write what's called a computer readable medium claim. And it's basically, think of it as an old CD-ROM or a floppy disk. It's a computer-readable medium. But now, how often can you buy an actual disk with your program on it? You just download it. The signal that carries the software is the computer-readable medium, but it's not patentable. Signals are not considered in the patentable realm. And a lot of times when people will draft an application and they'll have a computer-readable medium, and your claim is, we'll have a computer-readable medium comprising instructions that, when executed by a processor, cause the processor to perform operations comprising, and then you list the method steps. A lot of that type of stuff, the examiners are making people add non-transitory to that so that you can say that, okay, it's non-transitory. It's not a signal wave that's being propagated, because there was a Federal Circuit case that said, okay, signals are not patentable. The Supreme Court chose not to take that up and overturn that, which they easily could have. There are Supreme Court cases dealing with that back when the telephone first came out. There are some cases dealing with signals and things like that, and the court said, yeah, it's fine. And then some of the software stuff, they said, no, it's not fine. So it's, I think some people had said that goes back to the idea that the Supreme Court is sort of not liking patents. So they just chose not to take up that signal case. If they wanted to, they could have taken it up and reversed it, but I don't know. Who's?
Hi. Just noticing the lower courts applying Alice, it seems like there's always some sort of step involved where there's an analogy of the invention to some sort of pre-computing, pre-internet thing. something a secretary could do or something.
And that goes, I think a lot of that, what you're seeing is they're saying, okay, this is, it's old and well known, and you're basically just doing it on a computer. And then that's not okay. You know, people know how to add and subtract, therefore you can't go patent a calculator. That kind of, so you are seeing, I've seen that in some cases as well.
I just was wondering about the, it seems some are more or less far-fetched, and obviously it depends on how receptive the court is, but I just wondered if you had any thoughts on the potential rabbit hole there for these analogies.
If the analogy helps me, I'm all for it. If it hurts me, I think it sucks. I mean, that could be a dangerous area because then, well, you're slightly different from this one. How is that slightly different enough to get you over? Like in a completely non-related area, like in law school, I had to take constitutional law. You can read cases in the constitutional realm that sound. The fact patterns are almost exactly the same, and they come out completely opposite. It's almost like the court figures they figure out where they want it to, how they want the result to be, and then they argue their way to it. So I think with the analogies, you could be opening yourself up to something like that. It's like you're a little different, but now I want to make sure that this outcome is not like the other one. So I'm going to figure out a way just to make that one analogy so make it so completely different. It could be dangerous. Cold in here.
What about playing defense, like being a guppy in the Shark Tank, and you're trying to defend your product against someone who's basically using patent law to drive you out?
The American Invents Act, they have come up with a lot of like post-grant procedures that you can use to try to invalidate. The inter partes review procedures. These things are a lot cheaper than court. You may only be in it for $500,000. I know, right? Let me just reach in my pocket and grab that for you. But, I mean, it's better than $1 million.
That's sitting around in my garage.
Exactly. It's in the couch cushion. But again, so in that sense, there are some procedures to try to help you in terms of defending. Some of that, from what I understand, some of my litigator friends have told me that they've seen settlements go down with the non-practicing entities. They've seen settlement values drop because, you know, I can spend the $500,000 for the inter partes review process, possibly get you invalidated. And then if you're a non-practicing entity, your whole revenue stream just went away because you can't sue anybody else. I mean, if your patent's ever declared invalid, it's just it, you're done. And so in that sense, the settlement values have dropped a little bit to some extent. Again, I don't know if that's necessarily good defense or not. I mean, it's one way that you can defend yourself. I just don't know.
Thanks. I wanted to ask how different this is in other countries and if that puts us at an advantage or disadvantage.
What do you mean?
In other countries, do they have similar processes in terms of cost and legal intricacies? And if so, are we on a level playing field, or is it a case where it's actually cheaper to do software in another country because of our patent system?
Because I don't deal in litigation, I don't know the answer to that. Okay. From what I understand, other countries are not as litigious as we are in America.
Okay.
So in that sense, there's not as much suing. But honestly, I just don't deal in litigation enough to know the answer to that.
And just to follow up on that too, I do a lot of prosecution in the U.S. and I use foreign associates to go in different jurisdictions. And at least in my technology art, right, which includes some software as it relates to medical diagnostics, the legal standards in different countries are all pretty different, and also the ability to enforce patents in different jurisdictions is as well. So, you know, when we think of Western cultures like the US, Canada, Europe, those are all pretty much on the same sort of playing field, even though what they consider patentable subject matter might be different, right? So I know some clients have been able to get these medical diagnostic claims in Europe, but they're not able to get them in the U.S. now, right? And so that's one aspect. But then also enforcing a patent somewhere in China, for example, you know, it's just culturally not something that's done. It's improved in the last 10 years, but before then, big deal, you had a Chinese patent, let's, you know, hang it on the wall. There's different aspects, but, you know, a lot of countries are working together to try and harmonize a lot of it, but it really is, it's country by country, and you need to look at what is patentable in those countries, and then the other question is, if it is patentable, what is enforcement like in that country? But the U.S. definitely, I would agree with you, is much more litigious.
Yeah, and like he was saying, a lot of the other countries, the Europeans, from what I understand, you know, they're not as, with software, they're a little stricter than we were. And now maybe we're becoming more in line with the Europeans in terms of what is, you know, patentable subject matter in terms of software. I don't know if we're quite where they're at or not, but... And a lot of people will look into that, like what he was saying with the, you know, why am I going to spend the money to get a patent in China when nobody enforces them in China? If a particular place has a somewhat sketchy legal system, people generally may not, you know, spend the money to get a patent there because there's no point. Anybody else?
As a software developer, you know, I see all these software patents. I think, okay, you know, I have a great idea, I think, for some software. I have no clue, without spending how much money, to know if there's already an existing patent out there that, before I even start developing, if I did invest a lot of time in developing it, mm-hmm. all of a sudden here comes this non-practicing editing entity saying, I want to share your profits because I have this patent on it.
Yep.
And some of these patents are exceedingly broad, saying basically, you do something on the internet and we're going to sue you, and oh, you can make us go away for $100,000. Well, I'm just a small software developer, I don't have that. The whole point of the constitutional clause was to encourage innovation.
Yep.
I don't see how this does anything but stifle innovation.
And some people argue that that's true. That some of these patents that were first issued on some of these processes, you know, back when the whole, you had the dot-com boom and everything was going, and what was it, the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of that stuff, when it was allowed, most of the examiners, if you ever look at the face of a patent, most of the references cited against it, they search in the patent office. They're not out there scouring the internet for different things. And some of these things were allowed because they couldn't find art to reject them. And so these broad patents were allowed, and these are the ones that you see your non-practicing entities, they'll want to buy, and then they'll try to enforce them for the settlement. It's, some people will say that, yeah, that does encourage innovation, because when they bring that patent to you, you now know about it, figure out a different way to do it, you know, innovate a new way to do whatever it is. But what you're saying is also valid in that they claimed you did something on the internet, therefore, you got to pay them. You know, in that sense, I think that's one area where you're seeing it hurt. And some people are saying that's where the patenting system is a little bit flawed in that regard, in that it didn't keep up at the time. There's some stuff that got through the patent office that maybe shouldn't have. And if that stuff wouldn't have gotten through, maybe we wouldn't be in this where we're at now. It's just that at the time, you know, the examiners couldn't just say, well, I know people have been doing this, therefore it's rejected. Because then you end up with a more of a subjective than an objective standard. And you couldn't do that. It goes back to that whole, if ridiculousness was a valid reason to reject an application, I can think of a lot of them I'd reject. And so in that sense, you know, it's just kind of the system we live in right now. As a software developer, that's, you know, you can try to find some stuff out there, and you can go and get freedom to operate opinions, things like that. But again, you have to spend a lot of money to do it.
And so, that just basically shuts down a lot of software development, because they're not willing to take the chance. Why put the energy into developing a software product if you're going to get hit by a submarine patent?
Well, be careful with the use of the word submarine patent. That's kind of a term of art. Some people call them Lemowitz patents. Used to, patents didn't publish, the applications didn't publish until they issued. And there was a guy, he figured it out. Well, he just kept applications buried in the patent office for a long time. And then when the technology caught up to his patents, he allowed it to surface. So they called them submarine patents. And I think when he died, he was worth like $700 million. He basically sued for a lot of the barcode scanners and ATM technology I mean, if you think about it, the guy was pretty brilliant. He should have patented that idea. I mean, I've seen patent applications on getting a patent application. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some ridiculous stuff out there. But, but like you said, I mean, there's no way around that. You've got to spend the money or forego the innovation.
Just to follow up on his question and my prior question, do you have any kind of like a gut feel on how these cases have been going from, let's say, one extreme, like a fellow who successfully sued RIM for hundreds of millions of dollars for the idea of a PDA?
Is that the one you were talking about where they almost shut down BlackBerry's?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the guy got like a $400 million settlement or something.
Exactly.
Crazy. Yeah.
Versus, I'm trying to think of, I had it on the tip of my tongue, but, here it is, opposite extreme of the whole Apple-Samsung fight going on, where Samsung actually pulled as an example of prior art versus Apple's, graphical user interfaces on their portable devices, Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey, a scene from there, saying, "Oh, look, we've got this scene from 2001 that came back in the 1970s, or 64, 1964, where the astronauts are looking at these things on their tabletops, reading news and things. It just looks like an iPad." Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, Apple has no claim. Between these two extremes, at least from my limited knowledge of legal issues, seem to be two extremes. Between industry giants, do you have, just based on your knowledge, do you say the needle tends to lean more one way or the other?
Well, I mean, based purely on
with
this
owning a patent versus just simply flipping a coin?
I mean, well, based on the statistics of what's been found invalid since Alice, based on, it's more than a coin toss. You're in the, exactly what the number was then. It's 346 patents have been in litigation, 212 found invalid, so roughly a 61% invalid post Alice. So it's a little bit, you're slightly leaning toward the invalid based on the recent court decisions. But I think, again, some of that will just, it'll take its time. And if the Supreme Court thought that Alice was supposed to be minor, maybe they'll take up another one and say, okay, maybe we'll add a little more to that. We'll do something about that if we want to try to fix it. Again, if it needs fixing, some people don't think it does. So
probably depends on where you are right now.
Well, exactly. If your patents are being found invalid, you probably think they need to fix this. If your patents are being upheld, you're fine. All right, and we'll call it a day.